We were joking about what relevant financial disclosures really mean. I just have irrelevant financial disclosures. Being a pharmacy academic, I kid my PharmD students about, you know, going to the pharmacy organization, professional meetings in the pharmaceutical industry, hospitality suite. So this half inch of my liver is part of my irrelevant disclosure. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here and support this wonderful work that Maggie's been doing in the International Health section. My lovely colleague, Ms. Aruru, and I set out to write three papers for our presentation at APHA. We got two of them done, but I apologize on this one because it's much easier abstracting a PowerPoint from a written paper than trying to put together a PowerPoint from a paper that is yet to be written. So I've overloaded these slides, and basically I'm assuming you're as bright as my graduate students at UIC, and you can read the slides while I basically end up highlighting a few points. And here the key thing is, even before this economic collapse that we're witnessing in the world today, the pharmaceutical industry was in trouble, all right? And basically, this is an issue. We all own pharmaceutical industry stocks, whether you're a purist or not on that, and you say, I would never buy Merck, and I'd recommend not buying it, nor Pfizer, nor a lot of others. But basically, if you have TIA CREF as a academic, you're in a union health and welfare fund, or you have a mutual fund, or as we all do, we own bank stocks now. We own pharmaceutical stocks. And before this present collapse, they were not holding up to be recession-proof, because they were going through a lot of turmoil. In fact, it was one of the worst performing sectors before the collapse, and it is likely not to come back as a sector, you know, techs and mid-caps and things like that, if you follow the stock market. And these are some of the reasons why, you know, with the management muck-ups being one of the important things, they just have not been understanding their work environment, and the situation has just not been impressive for a while. They're now all looking around for new business models, but this is with people knowing a lot more about the pharmaceutical industry in American society and in key places in the society than they ever did before. There's about 200 firms in the world pharmaceutical industry. This includes the brand companies, the generic companies, the biotechs, and OTCs, and from different multinational companies. For you, my friends, basically you're concerned with the large brand multinational companies, and this is the list that you're probably most familiar with. And most of them are over in the exhibit hall giving you out pens and scratch pads and things like that, flashlights and everything else. All right. This is not a situation that comes just from my analysis, but from industry insiders, from financial analysts. Pharmaceutical industry is going through one of its most profound periods of change. And here are the companies where the multinationals come from, seven Northern Hemisphere nations that you're probably all familiar with, and you can identify the big group from last time to these countries. All right, just a little bit here in terms of our U.S. situation. Fact of the matter is that things have been changing. More people are aware of what's going on. A lot of publicity to the pharmaceutical industry. The whole question of cost of medications going up and up and up, people being denied access, having problems, and basically If you're watching the World Series, you know all about Daly, Cialis, and all the other drugs that people have learned about from DCT, up to $6 billion a year in expenditures. Everybody knows about the safety problems that have come together. And clearly, patients and payers are concerned about all these issues of prices, safety, efficacy, appropriateness, comparative effectiveness. Obama and McCain are both promising that, along with IT as being the great cost savings. You can't help but watch Cub reporters picking up on medication errors. A lot of flurry in the medical and pharmacy profession around this. Pharmacovigilance, term that's active in the drug industry today, is being acknowledged. We got a long way to go in drug safety as we're trying to do. If you want to learn about the ethical drug company and you want the best international picture, here's the U.S. population. We're 6% of the 6.5 billion people in the world today, and here's what we spend on drugs in 2002. 46% of drug expenditures. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this. One, back then, we weren't using as many generics. We're high utilizers of brand name drugs, which cost a lot of money, and basically there's no price regulation here. That's the picture then. This is the picture that's projected for 2012. You can see a significant growth in the rest of the world and a shrinkage in the U.S. The pharmaceutical industry recognizes this, and that's why they're looking elsewhere for new markets. All right. Drug spending in the U.S. is that $286 billion. It's slowed down in its growth dramatically, and this last year was the slowest growth since 1961. Scripts are not increasing as dramatically either. In fact, in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago, Walgreens reported that with this economic downturn, people are not filling scripts. All right, it's the first time scripts in the country have fallen. All right, here is the phenomena here that is not just pharmacy benefit management organizations, but Medicare Part D. $17 billion, a part of this is for generics. Most PBMs have generic prescribing rates over 50%. The Medicare Part D is almost reaching 60-some percent now of generics versus brand-name drugs. This is evidence of the poor pipeline. $441 million of this $286 billion was new drug introductions, all right? And so therefore, we're looking around the world for new markets, and this is how it comes out to be. Of that drug spend, about 80% of it is brand drugs and the biologicals, which have not gone generic yet. Generics, obviously, a lot less costly for most cases in the U.S. market. You can get them for 40% of the brand drug price. But please understand this. The drug spend doesn't include what most people in the Southern Hemisphere utilize in terms of natural medicines, herbals and other folk medicines and things of that nature. And this is why unregulated price, unlike almost every other country of the world. In the global drug market, every country of the world, as you know, has problems with cost and access and quality, and the needs are not being met. Management reform is definitely necessary. The neoliberal model that's been promoted by the World Bank has been failing in many countries with its privatization. This is very important to look at. Pharmaceutical costs are a phenomenal burden to developing countries. Not only does it mean when you have an imported brand drug that it's a cost to the public budget for taking care of the citizens, but it also means that you have a balance of trade deficit and you also have a balance of payments deficit. Countries that spend a lot on brand name drugs. And if you talk to Ellen Schaefer and the people in the Health and Trade Group, you notice that this is a critical issue for countries when the innovative brand drugs in the free trade agreements are struck, and what that means for developing nations. Now, please understand this too, and most people do not know this, and I am always furious at graduate students that get this wrong. You've all seen the pie charts of the $2.3 trillion in the U.S. Expenditures, and it has hospitals and doctors and drug companies and nursing home and all that. The 10% that pharma always talks about that we spend on drugs is only in community pharmacy, that spend. As you well know, if you're a practicing physician, physicians interject a lot of medicine into patients, and they have markups and they charge for that. All your cancer chemotherapies and things like that, or hospitals. Typical hospital can have up to 46% of its budget, if it's an academic medical center, in drug spend. Nursing homes, phenomenal amount of money in terms of drugs, and all the other settings. There's drug expenditures in all those areas that are not part of that 10%. So we're talking about in the U.S., 25% may be reasonable in terms of our total health expenditures going to pharmaceuticals. Now, what's happening with pharmaceutical companies? Basically, they're fearing federal price controls. Obviously, the Democrats have been talking about this. Why not do public health service pricing like we do for the military, for the VA, for Medicare Part D? They're also very upset by the fact that large purchasers get volume discounts, and PBMs have been a countervailing force, as well as for-profit hospital chains and for-profit nursing home chains, and even state Medicaid agencies are starting to say, we want to negotiate for better prices. We want something different than this crazy marketplace that we have. Little story, I'm on the board of directors of the Health and Medicine Policy Research Group, and John Conyers, the congressman from Michigan, has been a good friend of Quentin Young's, who serves on the board with me. He was invited to our board meeting one time, and I was talking to Conyers, and he said, you know, Dr. Salmon, we got 3 pharmaceutical lobbyists for every member of Congress. And he says, I send them all over the Daschle, all right? And you know, Daschle's already got 4. And I said, I thought you said he had 3. He says, well, his wife is a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry. My friends, Daschle is talked about as being the next Health and Human Services Secretary, so under Obama. So you're going to have issues with where we go with health policy in the future. The pharmaceutical industry spends a lot on lobbying. You can see this expenditure. There were 5 CEOs of drug companies making nice out in Denver at the Democratic Party because they recognized that the Democrats were likely to win. Obama is getting about twice the amount of money that McCain has gotten from the pharmaceutical industry for his campaign. And it was just recently came out that for the first time, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association hired Democrats to work with Congress, all right? So there are changes in them looking forward to the new regime, all right? And trade policies are really a problem. I'm familiar. I spent some time in Thailand where I have a faculty appointment at Chulalongkorn University. The U.S.-Thai free trade agreement, you know, the bullion tactics that the Bush administration has done, the U.S. trade representative has done with most third world countries in terms of these agreements representing pharmaceutical industry perspectives. All right. Again, pipelines, patents, politics are a real problem. the new business models that are looked at, and this is coming from the pharmaceutical industry literature. They're looking for high efficacy treatments for smaller population cohorts, all right, so that you get a higher revenue per each treatment. These are the mini busters. You know, blockbusters are the billion-dollar drugs that we've had all the time from Lipitor all the way through. If you're in managed care, you call them budget busters, all right? But the blockbusters were the billion-dollar drugs. Now they're talking about maybe not making that $1 billion, but having a mini buster, but basically you would be getting a little higher per treatment revenue than your typical ambulatory drug that goes out to a mass group. Again, refocusing, re-engineering for focused and virtual R&D strategies for new molecular entities. Only a handful, as you well know, of new drugs are truly innovative. A lot of them are the Me Toos or the lookalikes. And you know, there are very few that are first in class. But the implications of these kinds of changes that are going on in this re-engineering is that you can have R&D networks that are cross-global. And this is one of the things that represents, again, from the industry perspective, a fundamental shift in the industry's operating environment. They're seeking different changes. All right. Patent expirations, you've probably read about, the pipelines are very scarce. The news media has picked up and said the FDA is not approving a lot of drug entities. Well, the FDA only approves an entity that's been submitted, and that pipeline has been a real problem. And the 25 years of blockbusters is over. The rising generic competition is not just a phenomenon of the United States with PBMs, and your Medicare Part D, but you know, the niche markets that I just mentioned, genomics and personalized medicine. I read this industry news constantly, and this all this promise. It's like Nixon's war on cancer. Remember the war on cancer? Nixon announced it, you know, right before Watergate, and we didn't win that war. We didn't win Vietnam. We didn't win Korea. We didn't win the war on poverty. We didn't win the war on drugs, you know, and maybe we won't be winning the war in Iraq either. But the promises of genomics are just outlandish. DTC is going away, maybe. It's changed dramatically. There are a lot of drugs that you can't find on your favorite news media anymore. You know, so if you're watching 60 Minutes and you're saying, what happened to Celebrex? What happened to Claritin? You know, they're not there anymore. They've been changing this. And Congress is talking about different kinds of regs, and the FDA is looking at it a little bit closely. Clinical trials cost a phenomenal amount of money. And this is both in terms of what it takes to go ahead and look at better drugs, better innovative drugs, but also the safety concerns. And the multi-site things, if you know what it's like to go ahead and pay overhead at the typical academic medical center, it's a very costly phenomena thing. That's why outsourcing is taking place. If you're interested, soon to be Dr. Ruru and I wrote an article on medical and pharmaceutical outsourcing to India, and we're finding out that clinical trials are 50% less costly in India and other countries. Not just clinical trials being outsourced, but R&D being outsourced. India, again, being a typical place because they have a very strong, historically strong drug industry, and outsourcing a lot of manufacturing. Your drugs are not made in America. You know, as you know, most of your cars aren't made in America either, even if they have a GM logo on it, because the parts come from elsewhere. That's the way the business globalization has taken place. A lot of drug companies are cash rich. There's talk about a lot of merger acquisition stuff. The Lilly ImClone acquisition, a lot of companies, in order to get some pipeline, are buying biotech companies that have historically been funded either by some drug industry inside money or by venture capital. These things, alliances, co-marketing, joint ventures, there's all kinds of examples of this in the pharmaceutical industry. This could be heightened in different ways. I don't know how that bounced in, but okay. All right, so again, before this economic crash and the spillover to emerging markets, because, you know, Asia and Africa and other Eastern European countries and things, Latin American countries are having a problem in the current crisis of credit and everything else. But there's that 5.6 billion people living in lower to middle income nations. They don't have health insurance, right? So in multinational insurance companies are looking to get some things going, as well as companies or countries are trying to go ahead and do privatization schemes along with neoliberal reforms. You know, and once they get drug benefits, if not, they can pay out of pocket. And the fact of the matter is, let me see if I can grab this now. There are rigorous markets out there because essentially middle-class people in emerging nations want modern medicine, and they got money to pay out of, this is just a little sampling of them, but you know there are other emerging markets out there, and basically, yes, okay. The Bush economy was growing at a good year, 3% a year. Many of these countries, as you know, England, India and China were going 8 to 9%, some at 10%. And again, we're in the midst of massive layoffs in the pharmaceutical industry. Tens of thousands of pharmaceutical workers who thought they had jobs for life are now finding themselves on the street. Pfizer has gotten rid of cardiovascular, so you even got research scientists in the area of doing R&D have been thrown out. All right. 80% of the world's disease burden is in the southern hemisphere, but obviously there's not a high level of profit there. All right. Chronic disease patterns are picking up, and this is where, again, people who can afford the drugs that we can export very readily from the American multinationals. Neoliberal policies of promoting privatization schemes so that there are insurance mechanisms available. I ran a seminar for my students a couple years ago, and 50 to 70% of the revenues that most U.S. companies were coming from international markets. Shearing Plough just announced that 70% of its money comes from overseas, all right? We do have the diseases of neglect and the endemic diseases. They get some attention through Gates, Clinton, and UN sources, but we also have vaccine markets that are developing. All right, there is a lot of fight back in WTO circles, regulatory aspects, cost effectiveness and pharmacovigilance in most other countries is taking a lot more seriously than we have done here in the United States. Europe is surely ahead of us. As I mentioned, the charitable industry has mechanisms of talking about the health needs and what pharmaceuticals can do for them, how that all interplays. You can go ahead and check and see who sits on the board, who advises, and how these companies work with some of our friends here too. Pricing reimbursement is getting tougher all the time because of the cost crisis. The bilateral trade pacts are always an end run against generics, particularly the domestic generic industries. And these countries are becoming generic strongholds, and they're representing themselves very nicely. And policies that have really put us behind, Bush's stem cell policy allowed a lot of other places to move up fast. All right. Drug companies have a weakening public image, as you probably well know. The U.S. and European markets are not showing the growth promise. Drug access confrontations come across the world, not just for the AIDS, malaria, TB stuff, but other areas. R&D costs, ideas, and pipelines have a drought. in the European as well as American companies. Stock prices are down. High pricing and the profit margins are going to be questionable, and the drug safety pharmacovigilance costs are there. All right, these are available. These slides are available in the APHA for you to go ahead and check out. Just want to point out about generic companies now are multinational, large billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar corporations. There are generic companies that are part of the multinational brand companies. Again, a new strategy is to recognize that when you have a brand drug going off patent, you got your distribution system going, you got your factories all set up, you got your contracts for buying the ingredients, and so you end up continuing to produce these things. Other generic competition, India and China, and almost every other country of the world has phenomenal amounts of generics. Generics also are going through a merger phenomena. Teva, the largest generic in the world from Israel, just took over the U.S. company of Bayer, and the other companies are amalgamating in different ways too. Outsourcing, which comes into Meghna's discussion and also the compulsory licensing that we'll take care of. Just some other points to mention. Manufacturing is about 25% of the revenues. The ingredient costs, as many of you may or may not know, is usually 10 to 15% of the price of a drug. The rest of it's marketing, profits, promotion, things like that, yes. And drug safety questions and the questions of whether or not you got good manufacturing processes. If you've read about the Baxter multi-year, multi-million dollar contract with the pig intestine people in China, and then they wonder why there were deaths from this. Okay, drug access is necessary but insufficient. Infrastructure demands are definitely needed all throughout the world. Universal drug access with proper and timely care can save significant downstream costs, which usually end up in the public sector in the United States as well as around the world. Economic development, social development comes from meeting these needs. We're in a situation of Western pharmaceutical firms under new scrutiny, much more transparent and visible. Civil society advocacy is going on. And then compulsory licensing, my colleague Meghna will be talking about the developments of that as being one of these other challenges to the pharmaceutical industry. Thank you, then.
Thanks for a terrific overview, Jack. Meghna Aruru is our next speaker. And I know that she has a master's in business administration and a bachelor's in pharmacy from the University of Illinois. And other than that, I'm supposed to say she's with Jack.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you.